This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 25th of May 2013 on Monocle 24. A fresh-off-the-press national newspaper editor ready to do battle for her title, and a magazine editor with a newly minted title with a cultural twist. The printing press is warmed up and ready to roll for this brand new issue of The Stack on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Tuck, and over the next 60 minutes, we'll be meeting the people coming from two very different ends of the print spectrum. One brand new magazine title covering culture, and then a well-established national British newspaper keeping pace with our news digest revolution. We'll also speak to a New York-based editor whose clever, colourful magazine has managed to bridge the chasm between architecture and the arts.
You know, not everyone is going to want to read an essay on the philosophical merits of Parc Monceau in Paris, but, you know, they might really like a story on the Belvedere Motel in Fire Island.
All that and a look at the other magazines we all love on edition 39 of The Stack, live from Studio One in London. Hello, you're listening to another edition of The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. And just so you know, The Stack's proper host, Mr. Tyler Brulé, is in Singapore, but he's here with you in spirit. Today, The Stack is lucky to be joined by two editors from two radically different areas of the print world. One has just launched a brand new magazine, the other has taken up the editor's desk at one of the UK's foremost Sunday papers. Let's meet them now. Tom Viney is co-editor of the cultural journal Special Request, which launches this week. Every issue calls on contributors such as Jonathan Meads, Jeff Dyer and Jacob Holt to look in some detail at one part of a culture, in this case, food. Tom and creative partner Paul Sethi thought it was too simple to look at one part of a culture, food or art or even vintage cars, when a culture is a combination of many different things all working in concert. With this in mind, they launched a journal which looks at the entire human experience piece by piece, with some help from some pretty fine minds. So let's start with you, Tom. Tell us a little bit about the journal. It's an incredibly competitive market out there. But every week on The Stack, we seem to meet somebody who has amazing aspirations to start their own journal, their own magazine, and not on the web, not just as a swipe and read, but as a piece of print. What brought you to make your decision?
Panic, mostly. It sort of snowballed. Paul, my co-editor, phoned me about a year ago, said that he wanted to make a magazine. We made one. I don't know. I don't think we ever had any sort of aspiration to corner the market in food or culture or anything like that. We just wanted to put something out into the world which we could be proud of and which was a good read.
Now, what was your background? Were your background as a journalist, as a publisher?
I worked in book publishing and I still do.
And what was the temptation then to move into the world of magazines? You know, because if you're sitting in a publisher's house these days, most people feel incredibly challenged by what's going on in the market. There's a bit of unease about where we're headed. What's interesting is, I guess, both in books and in magazines, we're finding these kind of niches where you can be successful. So there are many good bookshops that are actually doing incredibly well because they're better curated, they've got a better understanding of their audience. Is this something you thought you could bring from publishing, as it were, to the world of magazines?
Yeah, it's pretty gruesome out there. I honestly don't think we had that many business considerations in mind when we started it. We just wanted to make a good magazine. But I feel like if you put something out there that's beautiful and tangible and an object which can be archived and kept and reread over the years, there will always be a market for it. I think that people will always buy that if the content is right.
Now, before we meet Lisa, just give us a few facts. It's going to come out how often?
Hopefully quarterly. But yeah, it's pretty loose. It's pretty
and,
loose.
And your distribution is the UK or global?
Global. So we're represented by Anten Books in the UK, and they send them out to Europe and Japan, everywhere. And then we're also getting a US distributor as well.
And then just tell me, how many are you going to print first off?
Our first run is 2,500, but I mean, hopefully we're going to do a lot more.
So that allows you to have a cover price that really means you don't have to caught any advertisers, you can make your money back from... You have quite a hefty cover price. I think it's £9.
Yeah,
right?
£9. Yeah, I'd say that's about right. I mean, in our first issue, we didn't want any advertising at all because we wanted to put something into the world which was completely flawless and not compromised in any way. But we would... I mean, I think that we are going to be looking at advertising solutions further down the line.
Good. Well, we're going to quiz you lots more about that and many other things about the world of publishing in just a second. Lisa Markwell is the newly appointed editor of The Independent on Sunday, a long-standing member of The Independent staff as executive editor, features editor, and at different points, both editor of the Saturday and the Sunday supplements. She has also worked at Condé Nast and at the Sunday Times and at the Mail on Sunday. She is one of just two female national newspaper editors in the UK, and her interests range from restaurants to child poverty via fashion, travel, and reform of the care system, and many other points in between. Lisa, great to have you on the show, and congratulations on your appointment.
Thank you very much.
We were just talking there about the world of books and the challenges there. It's also a kind of very challenging market for the world of newspapers, and you take the helm at a very interesting time when I guess newspapers are beginning to realise what they need to do. We've gone through a period of maybe 5-10 years where the market just seemed to quake and nobody really had any idea what to do. Do you feel quite confident that you now have a vision and a kind of a direction for The Independent on Sunday that will allow you to create something, you know, special and unique and, you know, reclaim some territory even?
Well, I think the death knell for newspapers has been rung for as long as I've been in newspapers, which is many, many decades, and we're all still here pretty much. So I think although the challenges are probably deeper and more financial than we've ever seen before, and there are certainly worries about how we interact with rolling news, what's going on in the world at the moment in terms of, you know, how quickly news can break and with Twitter and the internet, the challenge for a newspaper is still to be relevant. But I think that's a positive challenge. I think that's something really exciting. And particularly in the Sunday market, what you want is, and this sort of speaks to also what Tom and his magazine do, a moment to reflect and to offer readers something that they're not going to get from some, dare I say, ill-considered sort of rolling out of sort of unedited matter.
Now, you've had an extraordinary career at The Independent, and I must say that I also had a part of my career at The Independent, so we've crossed paths before.
Yeah.
But just tell me, day one, when you managed to get into the editor's seat, you've got the team, you know what you want to do. How quickly can you begin to have an impact on that newspaper? When you picked up the first issue edited by Lisa Markwell, did you think, yeah, already I can see the journey that I'm going to take this newspaper on?
Yes, I mean, I didn't have an enormous amount of time to prepare for taking on the new challenge. Yevgeny Lebedev, the proprietor of the papers, moves very quickly, and from talking to him to taking over was a matter of not that many days. One might say hours. So, I mean, obviously, I've been at the paper for a long time and I've seen the evolution in The Independent on Sunday going through a very interesting integration programme at the moment. So we are trying something which has been tried before, which is a 7-day operation. And the idea of that is that both editors, the Daily and the Sunday, can draw on a combined team of reporters, specialist writers, foreign correspondents, design talent, picture desks and so on. And that, although newspapers are very tribal and they're quite old-fashioned, as you all know from your days on newspapers, but this is a chance to tap into a combined talent and to move with the times a little bit more quickly. So the day I sat down in my office, first day, what shall I do with the newspaper, was almost not so much about what I'm going to put on the pages this week. It was like, who have I got at my disposal and how shall I shape what I want to do using that talent? I think that's the challenge. And my sort of editorial strategy is somewhat driven by that. And also, you know, The Independent on Sunday, although it hasn't got the circulation might of the Sunday Times, it's got a smaller circulation, but it's got an incredibly loyal circulation. So I'd be foolish to just say, you know what, I'm going to rip it all up and only cover sort of shoes and burgers. It's a successful title.
You talked about that moment of reflection, which is something I think which all magazines and newspapers are increasingly interested in. You know, whether you should be doing, as you say, you can't compete with the world of breaking news. The web can do that incredibly well. So you have to kind of rethink what the newspaper does now, especially a Sunday newspaper. And it's always been, I guess, a place for longer reads and bigger name writers. And I guess I wondered if you felt that that was the way to go, really, if it's analysis and comment should be taking... The Independent's always been good at doing that, even on their front pages. Is that the kind of direction you feel that a newspaper like yours will need to travel in?
Very much. I think one of the things that The Independent on Sunday has always had going for it, as you mentioned just now, is the quality of the contributors. So we've got, you know, Robert Fisk, Patrick Coburn, David Osborne, Archie Bland. We've got writers who really are exceptional at that sort of long-form journalism, and the Sunday paper is a place for that. However, I don't think that the Sundays anymore are a forum just for backward-looking and for reviewing the week that has just been. I think, of course, there's a place for that. But Sundays have changed, and so I think it's as much about looking forward as looking back, and I would quite like to explore that area a bit more in my editorship.
Brilliant. Well, I'm going to be asking Lisa and Tom lots more questions, but you're listening to The Stack with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, as is tradition every week here on The Stack, we ask our guests to bring in some of their favourite titles. Tom, we're going to start with you. What have you brought in for us?
Tons. When you first told me to bring in a selection of magazines, I really panicked. I didn't know what I was going to bring. And then I realised very quickly that there are about 40 magazines that I wanted to talk about. So this is whittled down. I'm going to start with a magazine called Lucky Peach. I'm sure that everyone knows about it, but it's brilliant. By David Chang from New York. It's a quarterly food journal that is unfailingly funny and entertaining and interesting.
Now, what's interesting, the first issue of your magazine, Special Request, you look at the world of food in a very different way.
Quite a slanted way, yeah.
So, was this one of the inspirations, though, Lucky Peach, when you began to think about food? Because I guess what Lucky Peach has done is it's gone away from that high-gloss version of food coverage. Mm-hmm. I guess like an Apartmento for kind of interior design has done in interior design, Lucky Peach has done for food. It's kind of made it a bit more mass, but still kind of loving food, and still there are still recipes, and it's still kind of encouraging people to go out and eat. Whereas your magazine probably pulls back a little bit further. You have got a bit of a more arts, cultural take on that world.
Yeah, we've gone slightly rogue.
And I think you do have one of the most ugly pictures of food I've ever seen in my life. That kind of full frontal of kind of sweets, which is...
Oh, the sort of vomity looking
yes.
one. Yeah, yeah, it's pretty stunning that, isn't it? Thank you. It's a sort of analogue. We looked at Lucky Peach, obviously, and I think they're the sort of world leader in food at the moment. They're just incredible. Everything about the magazine is perfect. All the contributors are spot on. They've got incredible people writing for them. I mean, this one here has got John Jeremiah Sullivan on preserves, which is, he's a world-class writer talking about pickled.
Now, interesting with your magazine. So you've started off looking at the world of food. Now, you say you're not going to look at that in the next issue. Are you slightly concerned that you kind of do bring along an audience issue one and think, oh my God, I love this magazine. This is the kind of take on the world of, you know, food and drink that I'm interested in. And then you kind of ditch them slightly next issue when you suddenly do vintage cars. Or this element that you're trying to touch on, that all culture is interconnected, do you feel that you will be able to kind of journey those people through issue by issue when it does change topics completely?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that our relationship to food in this issue is so tangential that it won't be too much of a leap to move on to something else. And for our next one, we've got TV, which is another thing that almost everybody loves. So, yeah, I don't think it will be too much of an issue.
And Lisa, what's your first choice?
Well, as luck would have it, and without any forethought, I'd actually brought in Special Request, which is Tom's magazine.
Yeah, thank you.
I promise there was no bribery or anything involved in that. What was exciting, I mean, I walked around the newspaper office yesterday, and we've got quite a lot of young staff, people under the age of 30 at The Independent, which is incredibly exciting. And they know what's going on all the time, and so I tap into that for all sorts of things, where to go and eat and what to read and so on. And so I wandered around and said, you know, what magazines should I be talking about? I've got my own favourites, but I'm interested in what's out there. Almost as one, they said, have you seen Special Request? Have you seen it? And so I had to sort of go around and finally manage to prize one from the unyielding fingers of the deputy arts editor, who was like, bring it back, through gritted teeth. So I brought it in because I'm fascinated by food. And as we've just been saying, Lucky Peach is an extraordinary title. There are others, you know, Fire and Knives, Tim Haywood's Quarterly is really, really a wonderful piece of work. The Gourmand is terrific. You know, it's an area of great taste, dare I say, terrible pun. And, you know, I was fascinated by Special Request, but I'm also fascinated by the idea that this is a magazine which will, next time, as we've just been saying, go on to talk about other areas. I mean, there was a time when I was editing the Independent Saturday magazine where I had this idea that every week the magazine would be about a completely different subject. And that was my favourite time of editing the magazine, because one could just do that. So, you know what, we're going to do a whole issue about night. And so we had a neon on the cover which said the word night, and inside there was an essay about, you know, insomnia and things. And that, to me, is just such a wonderful way of saying, this is something that we think you're going to come back to and read again. This is not just about what's immediate. And that's really exciting, that special request.
We did an issue of Monocle, which was all about the world of defence. And literally every single word had a connection with defence. So whether it was, you know, the recipes, or whether it was, you know, culture, design, fashion. We even shot the fashion on a bunch of Gurkhas, which was amazing. But it was interesting because actually it's the only issue we had a few letters of complaint about, because there are some people who hate the military and they don't want anything to do with it. So we had maybe half a dozen letters of complaint, but it turned out to be one of our biggest sellers. And I always had this image of kind of soldiers kind of standing in a newsstand and seeing our title and thinking, oh, that's the magazine for me. And then the next month coming back and thinking, maybe it's not the title for me. Although we do cover defence every issue.
But that's our job, I think, to challenge people. I mean, that's part of the world of publishing and journalism, that you take people on a journey and you say, you might not know anything about this, you might think you're not interested, but why don't you just give it a go?
Because you did come up through restaurant reviewing as well. You've kept that as a sideline while being kind of a tough, hardened news editor. You've been off in the evenings reviewing restaurants. Did you find those, was that an escape from the day, or did you find it all part of the spectrum of being, you know, a good newspaper editor?
Well, I'm afraid it's pure greed. I gave myself that job while I was editing the Independent on Sundays magazine, because I love eating out, and I thought, well, we've got a vacancy for a restaurant reviewer, how about me? I think that it's an incredibly important time for restaurants and food in this country, and in fact around the world. And in your introduction you mentioned that I'm interested in everything from restaurants to child poverty. You know, I'm fascinated in everything to do with food. It's just extraordinary to me that restaurants that charge, you know, £35 for a small piece of fish are packed every single night, and equally people are queuing for an hour and a half to, you know, eat a sort of dead hippie burger at Meat Liquor. You know, these are people are really, really interested in food. And I do see it as part of, you know, I am going to keep the job going, my sideline going, I hope. Not least because my husband only gets to see me when we go out to review restaurants. But also because I think, you know, you see people, you observe people's, you know, social interactions, you see what's happening in the scene, you meet people, queue for a burger or a hot dog or whatever. You know, it's quite an important part of the way we live. And so I'd like to keep that up. Although, you know, I might be the only newspaper editor who has a sideline in reviewing restaurants, I think.
Tom, your next title.
I brought in tons. I thought The New Yorker, because it's a classic. I think we both brought in The New Yorker.
We did.
Maybe we should do this as a team. But I actually brought in two copies of The New Yorker, one from 1969 that was just sort of lounging in my bathroom.
And that's because you're a buyer of old magazines as well?
No, it just happened to be in my bathroom.
Since 1969?
No, not since 1969, but almost. And I brought in two, so one from 2013, one from 1969, because I think it's incredible how little this magazine has changed. It's almost exactly the same. We were both poring over them in the waiting room just there. Even the font is similar. The cartoons are completely identical. And the content is pretty much the same as well. Nothing changes. They've got the monopoly on continuity, I think.
Now, you're obviously somebody who likes a good writer. And is that what weds you to The New Yorker, the quality of the writing?
Yeah, they have the monopoly on talent as well. They really do. They always have the most interesting fiction and the most immersive, brilliant features. They're a wonderful
publication. Now, there's a genuine thing, I think, in the market for all of us is, you know, that our attention spans, even, you know, we want our kids to have better attention spans, but ourselves, it's changed. We have so many, you have a device in your hand all the time. Mm. You're on the tube, you're checking your mail. Do you still find the moment to sit down and read 20,000 words in The New Yorker?
I try to.
And what is your media diet then? Do you try and force yourself to read the weekend, or do you just naturally, when you get on the subway, would you read a New Yorker rather than kind of looking at your BlackBerry or your iPhone?
I'm actually more of a bookman. I'm normally sort of strolling around with enormous and like unwieldy books in my hand. But yeah, I mean, given the choice between The New Yorker and reading something much more throwaway, I would always go for The New Yorker. And yeah, I feel like one of their long essays is perfect for a tuned ride, you know, half an hour.
And it's a kind of interesting question for you when you're editing a newspaper. I guess you do think about people's day when they've got it on a Sunday, what a Sunday looks like. Now, you, as you say, you've got kids, you're married, you've got a job. Now, it's great to think you've published 50,000 words, but you do also wonder what happens to those 50,000 words and how you grab people's attention and how you get them to begin to really kind of sit down and dissect it. Does that sometimes come into your mind thinking, yeah, this is great, 2,500 words, but who's going to have time to read this on a Sunday while also cooking lunch and looking after their kids? And
yes, I think that's the challenge, is to offer people something that they can have a quick hit. You know, they can be prepared for the day and the week ahead from reading short news bulletins and analysis, but they can also have, and we talk about this a lot, you know, the treat of the read that they will go back to. For me, you know, a piece of writing by Patrick Coburn about Syria is something that is an appointment piece of writing, and you should make time in your Sunday or Monday or Tuesday. I don't mind when you do it, but you sit and you actually concentrate and you put the phone down and you read it, because that is something that will give you an extraordinary insight.
I also like the fact that actually Sunday papers, you kind of want to keep them around during the week as well. Unlike the daily paper, somehow that Sunday paper, you don't mind if it's still there on a Thursday when you get home from work, and you can still dip into it and read. Those pieces seem to have a kind of freshness as the week goes on.
I do enjoy, I love it when I travel on the tube, because quite often on Tuesdays and Wednesdays I'm carrying around one of the other Sunday supplements to read. And if I see someone else doing the same, if I see them with the New Review, which is my Sunday supplement, you know, I think that's fantastic. That's about what we were just talking about with the New Yorker. It doesn't quite matter when you pick it up, because, you know, a piece of quality writing, you know, 3 days later, it hasn't aged.
Well, Lisa and Tom are going to be staying with me, but first we can have a short break.
For many, the process of cooking is as pleasurable as the meal itself. Cue the school bell. From a Tasmanian cook who guides his guest from garden to kitchen, to a chef-led market journey in Israel, Monocle Films have hand-selected some cookery schools who focus their flavours on learning.
A wide variety of courses are available. There are 2-day butchery courses, a charcuterie special session, and even one focusing on tomatoes and all the ways to use them.
Eat, cook, learn on film on monocle.com.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Stack with me, Andrew Tuck. Architecture magazines have a tendency to be ever so slightly, how can we put it, dry. Plans, renderings and pages of construction material ads don't make for the most exciting reading, especially for non-architects amongst us. One man with both a magazine and architecture background saw this and decided to fill the gap. Felix Burichter, founder and editor of New York's Pin-Up magazine, knows what looks good and reads well, and combines the best aesthetics from the worlds of architecture and fashion. Monocle's David Pleasant spoke to Felix earlier about how it all began and found out about Pin-Up's brand new issue, A Brazilian Extravaganza.
Let's start by talking about Pin-Up. Where did it all start? It's a fantastic publication. It's going from strength to strength. You've just launching the new issue around about now. Tell us the story.
Well, the magazine started almost 7 years ago after a summer internship with Fantastic Man, actually, in Amsterdam. I studied architecture before and I worked as an architect, and I was sort of disillusioned with the daily routine of working as an architect, and I'd always been fascinated with print and had always dreamt of a magazine that would speak to my sensibilities regarding architecture, rather less technical and more sort of seeing everything through an architect's lens, but, you know, sort of approaching it from a broader cultural standpoint. It started while I was still working full-time as an architect, and it started more like a hobby, almost something that I would want to read myself. And then it kind of grew and grew and grew and grew.
And we're at the point now where it's kind of garnered a certain reputation and perhaps achieved what you say you set out to do, which is bridge that gap between the more cultural, dare I say it, more kind of fashion or hype side of things and architecture. Is that something that you can relate to?
Well, the two things I set out to do was, one, like I said, create something that I would want to read myself and that I would be interested in. And the other thing was to bring, because when you study architecture, you're constantly, when you tell people that you are an architect, everyone will tell you, not everyone, but so many people tell you that, oh God, if I hadn't become a lawyer, a dentist, an artist, you know, fill in the blank, they would have studied architecture. And I thought, oh, well, you know, all these people are fascinated by architecture. Where is the magazine that speaks to these sort of people, you know, sort of sophisticated demographic, but, you know, who aren't necessarily interested in the nitty gritty of the architecture profession. We just came out with a issue 14. I think we've achieved exactly that, because I think our readership is, or I know that our readership is half architects, but the other half is actually people who have no previous professional engagement with architecture, but who are just fascinated or interested in with the subject and who can relate to it through the way we present it. People from fashion, whether that's people with an art background.
And I mean, that doesn't say that doesn't kind of tone down the content, because if you flick through Pinup, you'll see essays, you'll see some really kind of hard-talking archy chat or philosophizing. There's all sorts of different kind of issues and stories told. But is there something that brings it all together? There's a definite style that you've kind of chosen and that kind of really expresses Pinup. It seems to be very unique. Is that something you developed over the issues, over the years, or was it a kind of vision that you had when you set off? Especially the visual style is something very distinctive and I think that really makes Pinup stand out.
Or starting Pinup, having had experience mostly with fashion titles, I think really shaped the way I wanted Pinup to look. And I must give full credit to Pinup's design director, Dylan Fracaretta, who is, you know, responsible for the way the design looks. And then I think, like you said, there's some really highfalutin intellectual content, but it's sort of balanced out by some very strong visual content as well. So I like to think that there's something for everyone. You know, not everyone is going to want to read an essay on the philosophical merits of Parc Monceau in Paris, but, you know, they might really like a story on the Belvedere Motel in Fire Island, which is, you know, was purely visual. So I think there's a balance that kind of speaks to both. We sort of started making city or country specific issues in 2010, when after a prolonged stay in Los Angeles, and we made a LA issue, and it sort of struck us that it was a nice way of, we have a very small structure to that, it allows us to sort of travel a lot more than, let's say, you know, a bigger magazine, and sort of move the office around from issue to issue. And so we started with LA, then we did Berlin, and quite frankly, the inspiration for the Brazil issue came from being in Berlin in January and during one of the coldest winters. And I thought, wouldn't it be nice to be in the Southern Hemisphere next year about the same time in January? You know, obviously, I mean, Brazil, there's some obvious reasons why Brazil right now, because Brazil has of course been for years been an incredible place of culture production, but leading up to, you know, in the past couple of years, Brazil has seen a tremendous growth economically, but also artistically and in architecture, of course, leading up to the World Cup and leading up to the Olympics. I thought this was a perfect time to do some field research and do a special on it.
Well, you've certainly achieved that. I mean, looking through it, it's, I don't know how many pages all about
it's
Brazil.
60 pages.
60 yeah. pages.
60 out of 240 or 230.
And it's fantastic. And I recommend that if anybody's into architecture or cities and is thinking of going to Brazil, they should take a copy of Pinup with them, because the depth of architectural research is really astounding. That I like that you featured the kind of paving stones of São Paulo as a pattern. There's one artist who's doing something with that, and there's all sorts of aspects of the kind of visual and architectural scene in Brazil covered. tell us about one of your favourites in that story, one of your kind of best experiences or kind of one of the things that you came across that you thought you wouldn't.
Well, I think one of the story you just mentioned is actually a very good example. I spend most of the time in São Paulo with trips around the small or shorter trips around the country. But São Paulo really, is, to me, summarizes the Brazil experience in many ways because of the multicultural population, of the cultural production in terms of architecture, art. I mean, it's the center for everything, and things actually get done in São Paulo, at least faster than in other parts of the country. So the paving stones is one of those gems that you only discover once you actually go, because it's not something that Brazil is a country that inspires sort of fantasy in so many people, but it's a very different experience once you actually go down there and live it and breathe it yourself.
That was Monocle's David Pleasant speaking to Felix Berukta of Pinup magazine. You're listening to The Stack with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, let's return to our guests. This week, I'm in the company of Tom Viney, who is the editor of the brand new Special Request magazine, and Lisa Markwell, editor of The Independent on Sunday here in the UK. Now, it was interesting hearing him talk about getting that magazine out there, how he's having to kind of sell it around the world. Tom, you're sending out your baby into the world. Does it concern you that the journey it takes? You know, I know here at Monocle, one of the most weird things is as you travel around the world, you think, every news agent you go into, you try and check where it is on the newsstand, and you suddenly think, why is it in with women's titles in this obscure news agent? You're moving it all the time.
Your desperate urge to rearrange.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I'm very familiar with it.
There's a lot of that goes on with us. Now tell me, as you send it out there, what is your distribution? You've got this distributor, but are they going to put it in news agents, in art galleries, or...?
Well, yeah, all of the above, really. We've also got a wonderful deal going with Urban Outfitters, who are taking a lot of copies, and yeah, it's going to be everywhere, hopefully. Sort of high-end news agents, galleries, bookshops, all of the usual places.
And where do you expect it to go on the newsstand? Because as we said, this first issue is about food.
Yeah.
Is there, again, that's the tricky thing. Is someone going to put it as a food title this month and as a car title next month?
I hope it's not going to be stuck in between Cupcake Monthly and something else. Yeah, it's difficult. I mean, God knows, it should really have its own section somewhere right at the back where no one can see it. But I don't know, maybe it's going to rove around. We'll see. Actually, no, I do know the answer to that question. Anten Books are very, very good at grouping all of their titles together. So it would be there with Moose, The Gourmand, all of those sort of artsy titles. It would have its own.
Well, let's dip back into magazines, because you have a copy of Moose in front of you.
I do.
Tell us about Moose.
Oh, it's brilliant. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. It's an arts title.
Not just because it's with your distributor.
No, not at all. Completely independent of that. It's published in Milan. It's written in English and Italian, and it's printed on newsprint, but perfect bound like a magazine, and it's just stunning. As a result of being printed on newsprint, they can fit in so much content. Like, they can actually afford to print so much content. So there's hundreds of pages, there's all of these big brilliant features that deal with quite sort of risky stuff. They poke fun at the art world. It's a really fantastic magazine.
And do you know how regularly that comes out?
Every 2 months.
And it's a really beautiful idea. It's it's the use of the kind of the meeting of newspaper and magazine in one title is great. And as you say, it does make it more affordable, I guess, to kind of print a giant newspaper.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, and Lisa, your next title.
The next magazine that I've chosen is another one that's hot off the press, actually. It's called Hole and Corner, and I think it's just landing now. It's a wonderfully reflective title. I mean, we've touched on that several times over our conversation today. This is a magazine that's about craft, beauty, passion and skill. That's their sort of little selling line. And it's got a feature in it in this first issue about brushes, all the sorts of different beautiful brushes that you come across in life. Well, there are not many titles that would do that, certainly up until recently. I mean, I do think we're in a golden age of sort of niche titles, and I think it's really interesting talking about news agents and how they display these magazines and where they put them. I actually sort of think a forward-thinking news agent would actually throw away their sort of standard ideas of where to put magazines and just have a sort of this is the niche magazine area, where there will be a magazine about, there's Bone Shaker, which is about bicycles, there's The Blizzard, which is a football title, which is extraordinary, there's Pop Shot, there's Moose, there's all these things. If you had an area which was just like, you don't know that you're interested in this, but how about you look at this section and you might find something. Hole and Corner sort of taps into that. I mean, it's been started by a young man called Sam Walton, who I've known for a very long time. In fact, we've lost touch for a while. He's a designer by trade, an art director. And I think this is something that's been percolating for probably very many years for him. I mean, he's moved out of London. He's sort of at one with nature in many ways. You know, I think he loves fishing and things, and that comes across in the magazine. But it's also got an incredibly refined selection process about what they include, the people that they include, and the way the magazine's designed. And it's just a rather beautiful, it's sort of almost like a visual version of The New Yorker, in that, you know, it's like, let's just stop and look at a picture.
I saw a copy of this yesterday, and I think we're going to try and get Sam on the stack actually in the next couple of weeks. And what struck me about you, what he's doing, what you're doing with Special Request, is, you know, that of course, you know, 15, 20 years ago, lots of people were bringing out magazines that were independent, but they tended to be kind of slightly photocopied and stapled in their art design. And I looked at Hole and Corner. No, that's as good as anything being put out by the big publishers. And I think what's fascinating is, because you know very well, Lisa, what the big publishing companies, the Condé Nast of this world, you know, they do a great job, but it's very difficult for them to bring anything new to market unless it's going to sell hundreds of thousands of copies. So in fact, all the creativity kind of seeps away from them, and suddenly there's this whole group of people who are doing things on print like you, because actually they're nimble, they can get into the market, they can make a name for themselves, and actually they can begin to grow a really interesting business that isn't dependent on selling hundreds of thousands of magazines. We see that in the US with titles closed down because they're no longer selling 2 or 3 million, they're just selling, you know, a million. And you think, well, this is crazy. This is, you know, we can't sustain these titles.
I think this is a really interesting process that you're talking about, because I actually think this is going to be something that speaks all across publishing, and the big publishing houses and the newspapers are going to have to look at this and say, okay, the volume is not going to be there any longer because the internet has taken over on volume. That's where you're looking for 2, 3 million, 20 million, whatever the mail online clicks are, zillions. But it's about a smaller number of people who are a specific target audience and are going to interact with what you're publishing. And so the word niche isn't necessarily appropriate for a newspaper, but a sort of smaller volumes, but sort of better volumes. I think that's where we're going everywhere, newspapers to magazines, all across.
Yeah, and I think also because people begin to disbelieve the numbers, because, you know, a newspaper says, you know, we have like, you know, 100 million people checking our website every day. Well, maybe, but also, who are they? Mm. And suddenly, with the title like The Independent on Sunday, and I think that's the real strength you have, is, you know, that you have an amazing readership. When, you know, the people you see reading it, you know they've got a good opinion. You know they're a really core audience. Mm. And, you know, as newspapers all begin to, you know, lose some of their readers, it's who stays at your core, and you have a great core reader. Do you have no idea yet who's going to pick up your magazine?
None at all.
Who's going to be your friends? You know, who's going to love you?
Well, hopefully nice people. Hopefully nice people.
It's like it's like going out on a first date, isn't it? You're kind of all dressed up, ready to go, but you're not
quite.
It's
like internet dating. Yeah, there's something very, yeah, it's very odd. It's certainly nerve-wracking. But yeah, we have no idea who our target market is yet. Well, okay. We know the kind of people that we want to talk to, but we don't know who they are or whether they even exist.
Let's take one more title from you. What else? Because you did bring a very big pile.
Huge stack. I'm so sorry.
No. That's why it's called a stack. It wouldn't be much of a stack if there wasn't anything in it.
No,
it.
True. Well, actually, yeah, on the subject of keyhole publishing, I brought two titles which are very specific. First of all, The Plant Journal, which is about plants. I don't know how much mileage there is in that, but it's very interesting. I mean, it is literally just about plants. There are articles on hyacinths and the proper Latin names of various garden shrubs, etc., etc. And then I also bought a magazine called Day Job, which is wonderful, which is published in New York, and it's a magazine about work. And I don't think anyone's really done that yet. There are lots of magazines about food, clothes, all of these other huge elements of our day-to-day lives, but not the biggest one, which is what we do for a living. It's full of really interesting essays on the world of work, and I think it's a format which will just keep going. It's great.
And do you have one last title as well, Lisa?
Well, I did bring along The New Yorker, but we've talked about that a bit. But, I mean, I would just say that I have got copies of The New Yorker going back, not to 1969, but certainly probably 15, 16 years old, which I know that I could pluck any one of them at random and read it, and there'd be an incredible article about prisoners in solitary confinement or the people who make ice machines in Brooklyn, you know, and I would read that with great pleasure. But the other title that I brought in is something called Delayed Gratification, which, you know, is a rather strange title in itself. And their little subline is Last to Breaking News, which for a newspaper editor is probably a slightly strange thing. But in my time off, I like to slow right down. And this is a magazine which is, it's a very sort of urgent design, actually. It's quite unlike the other magazines we've talked about because it's packed with graphics and illustrations, and every page is sort of, the text goes right to the, almost right to the sort of the edges of the page. So it's quite urgent in its look, but in the way it addresses topics, it's very calm and reflective, and it's saying, this is something that you, this is a book that came out that you might not have been aware of, or we're going to analyse, you know, a tennis match from X number of years ago. And I really like that approach.
I think that's an interesting thing to comment on there, which is the speed between what happens on the internet and what happens on the printed page. There is a kind of slow media kind of movement almost. You want your printed word to kind of slow you down, to give you something that's at a different pace to what you frenetically see on the screen all that day.
That's right. And I think, well, my husband would say he's banned me from looking at Twitter in the bedroom because it just drives him crazy, seeing me sort of flickering through the screen. There has to be a place in everybody's lives for them to just slow down and read something, just not only for what you learn from the actual piece of material that you're reading, but just to keep our brains able to concentrate. I mean, we are actually, as you mentioned it yourself, you know, young children, and now, you know, their attention spans, I see it with my own teenagers, are so minute, and I can feel it in myself. And so the discipline of reading something slowly and reflectively is really important for our well-being.
Well, Lisa and Tom, stay with us, but we're going to have a short break.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental, it does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close, and there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well, it has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's A Review, every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock.
The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the Global Pulse.
I was at a bunga bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch, too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. The guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat...
We know that he had them, and we know that he used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
And welcome back to The Stack with me, Andrew Tuck, where our guests this week are Lisa Markwell, who is the new editor of The Independent on Sunday, and Tom Viney, who is the new editor of Special Request, well, the first editor of Special Request. Mm. Tom, the discipline of being an editor of a magazine, of getting out on deadline, of persuading people to do things, especially when you're a new title, was it difficult phoning up people saying, look, I'm doing this magazine, I presume, can you do something reasonably priced for us? Persuading people to come into the fold. Have you enjoyed that process?
Yeah, I have. And it wasn't just reasonably priced, it was free.
Okay.
Tiny. But, you know, I mean, I've got to stress it, it's not just me. It's me and Paul, we're co-editors, so we've done everything together. He handles all of the visual side of it and has done an incredible job. And I do all the words. But yeah, it was slightly nerve-wracking asking people to give us things. The worst for me was Jonathan Meads, who's always been a huge hero. And I emailed him, I asked him if he wanted to write something for us, and he said potentially. I took him out for a dinner.
It wasn't quite free. There was a meal involved.
There was a meal. There was a small meal. Tiny meal, actually. So yeah, we went out for this dinner and it was nerve-wracking. They say that you should never meet your heroes, and it's true. You sort of say some really stupid things, pull incredible faces. Yeah.
And Lisa, for you, you know, I don't want to dwell on this question, but it's, you are one of only two women now who run national titles here in the UK. Do you think that you bring anything different to the table being a woman editor?
Well, it's an interesting question, because part of me wants to say no, because if you're an editor, you're an editor, and you got there because you know how to be an editor. But it's undeniable that I think there is a difference. You know, my interests are very different to the editor of the daily paper. You know, he's got a background in business journalism, and I don't. And the amount of letters and complaints that the Independent's had over the years, I mean, I've worked there on and off for about 11 years, maybe longer. Why aren't there more women in the newspaper? And I think that's actually a legitimate complaint about quite a lot of newspapers. All the coverage that you see is, you know, here's Keira Knightley at a film premiere, and that's sort of, that's it. It's like, that ticks the box of having things about women in the newspaper. Well, as a woman who reads newspapers, that ain't what I'm looking for. And so I hope to bring a more rounded approach that I actually think a woman editor can bring. You know, I'm really, really interested in things like health. I'm really interested in education. I'm really interested in the way we live and social observation. And I'm not absolutely sure that all editors do that. So, you know, I might be making myself some enemies here, but I do think there is a certain facet of life that a woman might understand differently.
Now, I see it here, even at Monocle, where it's, you know, you commission a story and you ask somebody to come up with, you know, 10 people we should be interested in, you know, next year, or, you know, 20, you know, visionary urban leaders. Now, they'll come back to you and you suddenly look at the list and you realise they're all roughly the same person. They're all kind of white gentlemen of a certain demeanour. Now, you try to kind of overcome that. You go back to the writer and say, no, there must be an interesting woman. There must be somebody who isn't actually Anglo-Saxon. Who else should we be talking about? But the fact is that, you know, I just heard a story this morning. There's only two women now running FTSE 100 companies here in the UK. Mm. And the unfortunate thing is you do have to reflect the reality, I guess, as well. You know, so for you, do you find that balance between you kind of wanting to make sure there is more equal coverage and the kind of the grim reality of what the business world looks like or any of the parts of our society still look like? Mm. You still look, open the page and you think, oh my God, there's still quite a lot of bald white men on our pages.
Well, look, I wouldn't want to have a quota and say, okay, we must have, you know, at least 37%, you know, women in the newspaper. I think that would be insane. But it's absolutely right that, you know, that is what we are seeing. And we have to question, is that a true reflection of the world we inhabit? You know, and in fact, the answer is broadly yes. I think there's a Tumblr site of men-only organisations, and it's a brilliant collection of photographs of sort of lineups of boards of directors and things, and they're all men. And in fact, they're all largely white, middle-aged men. That's fascinating. You know, I do think that it's actually a really interesting time, and I'm delighted that I've taken over an editorship of a national paper at a time when feminism and women's interests are actually really being pushed in a really interesting way. You know, the everyday sexism Twitter feed and website is fascinating. Spare Rib is about to be relaunched next week, which, you know, obviously is at the very sort of furthest reaches of what I might do in my newspaper. But, you know, I'm fascinated to see what Charlotte Raven's going to do with that. The Vagenda is really, really interesting. Jezebel, the website in America. You know, I think we are at a really interesting time. And I'm not saying that I'm going to make a national newspaper into a sort of radical feminism title. But, you know, hello, there are women who have a voice and whose interests and whose skill set really should be making a bigger play in, you know, in business and across the world.
And Tom, almost to conclude with, not picking you up on women's issues, but perhaps just how you see yourself reflected in your news digest. You know, I know myself, when I often pick up all the British newspapers of a morning and I go through them, sometimes their take on the world seems so kind of alien and so kind of focused on things which seem daft, you know, or their angle on something is so kind of national bound that you think, I wish you'd travelled a little bit. I wish you would just even look across, you know, the channels, what's happening in Europe. You would have a kind of a richer take on things. When you crack open the newspaper, when you do look at the printed word, do you see yourself well reflected there? What newspaper titles would you feel, you know, actually do kind of take your pulse quite well?
I've always been a big fan of the International Herald Tribune, just for being not tied down to any of that sort of nationalist stuff. It's very broad. It looks at the whole world. There's no, you know, it's very it's measured in its approach to news coverage. But no, I don't really see myself reflected in any newspaper. But then, you know, I'm an individual and everyone is. And I don't think there's ever a perfect match. But there's lots of brilliant news out there. Lots of brilliant journalists.
Well, I think you should probably pick up Lisa Markwell's Independent on Sunday. I've got a feeling she seems more on your page than probably anybody else. Well, thank you both for joining us today. And thank you for both coming on The Stack.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of edition 39 of The Stack. My guests today have been Lisa Markwell and Tom Viney. Our producer was David Pleasant. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And our studio manager was Jack Phillips. If you have any comments or queries, then drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at 10 a.m. London time with a fresh batch of precious print. And of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com or iTunes. But for now, from me, Andrew Tuck, it's goodbye and have a good weekend.